Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
I'm Mike Pratz.
And I'm Jacob Avila.
Thanks for joining us today. We're coming to you from Montreal. Montreal, Canada, where we are currently at the World Congress of Ultrasound and Medical Education Conference.
And we're having a blast. There are so many intelligent and funny people here that are very passionate about what they do, and it's very refreshing. We love it.
Yeah, all the superstars are here. It's been a great time. And we thought of an idea that there's so much research and so much excitement that's being presented and talked about here that we wanted to just go through a few of the abstracts that we've seen here, because this is interesting progress that's being done, and you may not find out about it for a couple years, or you may not ever find out about it. Obviously, we have to give a little bit of a disclaimer, because when we're talking about this type of research, it's not as thoroughly peer-reviewed. It hasn't gone through all the rigor of being published in a journal. And some of this isn't complete research. Some of it's more preliminary results. So take everything that we say with a grain of salt. We just want to give you the ideas of what's been going on. Okay, our first study is one titled The One-Point Method, a Rapid Alternate Way of DVT Assessment.
What?
Yeah.
1 point?
So if anyone's been following along the point-of-care DVT literature, you know that this seems like a step in the wrong direction.
I know. I try to tell people to do like two zone technique. And in fact, I just tell them to scan the whole leg, because I feel like, you know, that isolated femoral vein clot that we worry about missing with the 2 point technique. What is this?
Right. Well, this is a paper that came out of Iran, or an abstract, I should say. And their main objective was they felt that people are not doing point-of-care DVT scans because it takes too long. So they wanted to think of an efficient way that you can do this. The one-point technique means you take your linear probe, you put it in the popliteal fossa, and you're checking for two things: compression of the popliteal vein, and then also respiratory phasicity. If any of those things are abnormal, then you subsequently go and do the proximal femoral veins and make sure there's not a clot. The idea with phasicity, in case you're not familiar with it, the idea is when, same as IVC collapsibility in spontaneously breathing people, when you decrease your intrathoracic pressure, you're going to be pulling blood forward and you should see a change in the flow in the vein. So the idea is that good phasicity means there's not a complete obstruction proximal to the spot, or I guess I should say between where your probe is and the chest.
So what you're saying is that if there is a clot in between your probe and the chest, that change in pressures is not going to be shown distal to the clot, basically. So you have like a plug in between the two systems.
Exactly. Now, okay. Theoretically, that should only work if it's a complete obstruction, because if there's still any flow through there, mm-hmm. you may be able to get some of that phasicity still. So I was always taught the lack of phasicity signifies probably a complete obstruction or close to it,
sure.
whereas if you do have phasicity, there still could be a clot.
Yeah, interesting concept. What did they find?
So they actually enrolled 347 patients. What they found was about 20% of the time there was a lack of phasicity and they had to go proximal. And only in 5.2% of the time did those patients have isolated femoral DVTs. So only in femoral, no popliteal DVT. And every one of those actually lacked phasicity in the popliteal region. So it seems like they didn't miss any with this exam.
That's fascinating. I mean, this is something that they had a good N, 347 patients. I'll be interested to see what the final peer-reviewed paper looks like. And for me, this is something I'm going to start thinking about a lot. I'm not going to practice just 1 point exam because I don't know if it works. But on my next patient that I suspect has a DVT, I'm probably going to start in the popliteal and look for the phasicity just to see if it works for me while I still do the 2-region technique, which is what I normally do.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think this is going to change what I do when I'm doing DVT point of care scans, but it is an interesting idea and maybe phasicity can be useful. I do want to emphasize, though, that compression is way more important than phasicity or augmentation or color Doppler, any other things you want to do. Always focus on the compression and the complete coaptation of the vein walls to rule out a DVT.
Yes.
All right, second study. This one's titled Prediction of Fluid Responsiveness Following Cardiac Surgery Using Doppler Renal Resistive Index.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing. We need more confusion in regards to fluid responsiveness, so that's perfect.
That's right. There's such a complete agreement in that there's only one good way, you know, rocking the boat. So renal resistive index, this is a Doppler measurement. So we're talking about spectral Doppler here. You get your little waveform on the screen. To measure this, you're going to be taking your systolic velocity peak. So that's the highest peak that you see on the waveform. And subtract from that your end diastolic velocity, the lowest. And then you take that and divide it by the peak systolic velocity. So the idea behind this study was maybe the changes in the blood flow to the kidney that are seen with this resistive index can be predictive of who would benefit from getting fluids. The way they decided to address this was they used the renal resistive index before and after a passive leg raise, and they compared it to cardiac output as measured by thermodilution.
That is great. That's like the gold standard that I think is easily reproducible. So I'm glad they used that thermodilution as their gold standard. So what were their numbers here?
So they had 30 patients that they enrolled in this study, kind of on the small side. Now, the end results were that the non-responders had a change of 0.042, and the people that did respond had a change of 0.008, and this was statistically significant.
Man, that is, I mean, it's a factor of like 100 or whatever, right? 0.008 to 0.042, but that's still like a really small number.
Yeah, I agree. And if you think about, this is probably a more novel technique for a lot of point of care users. So maybe there'll be even more variability depending on your training. Because as we know from Doppler studies, the angle that you're coming into the compared to the flow of blood is really going to affect the velocities that you're seeing. So I would be a little bit hesitant to make any decisions based on this minute of a change that we're seeing.
I agree. I don't know what else to say because I like, agree with you. Like,
yeah. So it's a cool idea, but I think it's a little bit too early. Maybe, you know, they only had 30 patients, so maybe if they start collecting a lot more patients. Mm-hmm. And I should have said this is only patients that got cardiac surgery, so a very unique population as well. So we'll see if it's reproducible on a larger scale and with a more broad population.
Yeah. One thing that I'd like to see also is I'd like to see like 10 different physicians do that resistive index in that same patient to see if that changes it all, you know, because that's one of our things with like doing VTIs, for instance, is that if you're a little off with your Doppler angle between one measurement and the other, that you have the same measurement, no change in fluid status has happened. But if your angle is a little off, you might be 10% different, which is what the fluid responsiveness kind of number is, you know, 10 to 15. So that's another part of that I'd like to see.
I agree. All right, third paper. This one's titled Suspected Small Bowel Obstruction in the Emergency Department, Accuracy of Point-of-Care Ultrasound.
Oh, man, I love bowel obstruction because invariably the literature shows that there's have a high sensitivity and a high specificity. So that's definitely what this study is going to show, right?
That's right. I don't enjoy bowel obstruction because every time I get one, it's just so uncomfortable. But in any case, yeah, so that's what we would hope. There's been some literature on this before, and everything usually comes out in favor of ultrasound being just, it usually blows abdominal x-ray out of the water, and it starts to approach the test characteristics of CT even some studies. So this one, it was cool because it's prospective, multi-center observational study in the emergency department. It's the population that we are interested in, and they ended up enrolling a total of 148 patients at three hospitals. The results were that their sensitivity was 88.5%.
What?
Specificity, 50%.
Ugh.
Yeah, likelihood ratios are 1.77 and negative likelihood ratio 0.23.
Wow. What was their diagnostic criteria for this?
So they looked at the usual stuff. They were seeing if there was to and fro peristalsis, if the diameter of the small bowel was greater than 25 millimeters. The other thing that they did look for, though, that I thought was interesting was a transition point.
Really? That's really not been mentioned before as a transition point in the literature.
Yeah, that's not one of the things they usually list, and they found it to be 96.6% specific. You know, the lack of transition point is what's often quoted to me by our surgeons as why they need the CT and they can't accept just an ultrasound, because they always say, we need to know where the transition point is. We need to know how that might affect operative management of this patient.
Yeah, gotcha. So this is the transition point might actually be the lung point of the bowel obstruction. One thing I'm interested in is why these numbers are different than other numbers. And I'm wondering if it just has to do with the people that are doing the scans. So that same group, I believe, did an appendix study, ER physician appendix study, where they found pretty, lower results than what we kind of expect. And when you actually read that article, what happened was is that they basically included everybody, from interns all the way up into fellowship-trained attendings, which that honestly might be a little more realistic of a study. And I'm wondering if that is one of the reasons why this study showed lower sensitivity and specificity. In that appendicitis study that same group did, they didn't really have any formal training that everybody had to do. They didn't have any proctored scans that everybody had to do. And I'm wondering if that might be the reason why the numbers here were lower. What if they just kind of let people loose, or they just did like a QPath kind of search function to look for it? That might be why their numbers are a little bit smaller, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good thought. And that's, you know, one of the problems of just looking at these abstracts. We don't have the robust method section to dig through and dissect and see how well does this relate to our patient population and right. What's the external validity of it.
But I'm really looking forward to all of these studies coming out. Now, there was a bunch of ones that we could have chose, but we kind of wanted to stick it to about three because we thought these were the ones that were the most interesting. And we thank the authors for putting this stuff out there, and really looking forward to them all being published hopefully soon.
Yeah, and thanks for joining us for another podcast. As always, you can check out our website, ultrasoundgel.org, contact us on Twitter, sign up for our mailing list, and we'll talk to you later.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel, more
ultrasound gel podcast.
What do you say? Hello, and welcome to the ultrasound gel podcast.
All right, let's try it.